Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I was skeptical about ordering foundation online. I can't even find a match in stores. Then I discovered Il Makiage. Their online quiz found my exact shade in seconds. With Try Before You Buy, you can try your full-size shade at home free for 14 days. But I was obsessed on day one. It's so lightweight and natural, it's literally my skin in a bottle. Take the quiz at ilmakiage.com/quiz. That's ilmakiage.com/quiz.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Monday, the 6th of July. Our main stories: India has the third biggest coronavirus outbreak in the world after overtaking Russia. Spain imposes its second local lockdown in 2 days because of fears over COVID-19. And more than 150 years after they were killed by French forces, 24 Algerian resistance fighters are buried in their homeland. Also in the podcast, Lewis Hamilton takes the knee as Formula One motor racing restarts.
There are still people that don't fully understand exactly what is happening and what are the reasons for these protests, and I continue to try and be that guider.
And our arts correspondent takes us to the Henry Moore Studios as museums and art galleries are finally able to reopen in England. At the start of the coronavirus pandemic, India seemed to have had some success in controlling the spread of COVID-19, particularly given its vast population. At the end of April, it had fewer than 35,000 cases. Now that figure has leapt to nearly 700,000, and India has overtaken Russia as the third most infected country in the world. A vast new treatment centre has been set up in the capital, Delhi, while the authorities have scrapped plans to reopen the Taj Mahal on Monday. So what went wrong in India? Our South Asia regional editor is Anbarasan Etirajan.
When they started relaxing some of these restrictions, what happened was people started congregating again. See, one problem was the test, number of tests, how many tests you conduct, because health experts would insist that test, so that you can do the test, do the tracing, and then you can isolate those people and treat. But India was not doing enough tests. Even now, people are saying the test rates are very, very low. And when the restrictions were relaxed, people started, you know, moving to markets like a fish market or vegetable markets. And again, that triggered more problems. So they had to reimpose lockdowns in cities like Chennai. They went through second lockdown, because it was also difficult to explain people about social distancing measures. If you're a low-income family, how can you live, you know, separately if you have any symptoms? Because most people will be living in one-bedroom or two-bedroom houses. So there are logistical issues. And also, the government authorities were initially not really active in terms of finding people, the contact tracing, and doing more tests.
So what are the authorities doing now to tackle the outbreak?
The authorities, what they are saying is, you know, many people have commented saying, you know, indirectly, that we have to live with the virus, because a country like India cannot afford to stay in a lockdown mode for a long time, because many people complained that if we don't die of coronavirus, we will die of hunger, because we have, you know, 100 million people depending on the daily wages. They have to find work so that they can find their meal. It is a huge country, you know, with the different rules for different regions, with 1.3 billion people. And the government is trying its best. What now they're doing is like increasing the number of centers. For example, in the capital, Delhi, they opened a 10,000-bed care center for those living in Delhi. And these are having a cardboard beds. But it doesn't seem to be that numbers are coming down. For example, in states like Maharashtra and in Tamil Nadu and Delhi, the numbers keep going up. The government is also focusing on other issues, for example, border tensions with China. And also, it has to revive the economy. And it is also, they have this federal structure where various state governments, they have their own issues to sort. For example, they're having fund crunches. They're asking the federal government to help them. And once they get the money, they hope that they can improve the situation.
Anbarasan Etirajan. A day after imposing coronavirus restrictions on 200,000 people in Catalonia, Spain has put another community back in lockdown, some 800 kilometres away in Galicia. The regional health minister said the outbreak was linked to several bars in the area. Reporting from Spain, Guy Hedgecoe.
From Monday, the area of Amarinha on the Atlantic coast will be cut off from the rest of Spain. Movement will be allowed within the zone, which has 70,000 inhabitants, but police will prevent people from entering or leaving without a specific reason. With 106 new cases of the virus in the area registered over the last 24 hours, the local authorities have said this is a precautionary measure, which is expected to last 5 days. Yesterday, the regional government of Catalonia in the northeast of Spain put the county of Segrià in isolation due to a spike in coronavirus cases. 2 weeks ago, Spain's government lifted a strict national lockdown on the grounds that the pandemic was under control. However, since then, there has been a number of new, mostly small outbreaks.
Guy Hedgko in Spain. The former president of Ukraine, Petro Poroshenko, has accused his successor, Volodymyr Zelensky, of pursuing him in the courts out of revenge. During his time in office, Mr. Poroshenko led Ukraine in its war against Russian-backed forces in eastern Ukraine. He claims that some of President Zelensky's key advisers are pro-Russian sympathisers. Our correspondent Jonah Fisher reports from Kiev.
Petro Alexeyevich Poroshenko!
Just over a year ago, Petro Poroshenko was Ukraine's president, leading his country's fight against Russian-backed rebels. This week, he was marching with his supporters through central Kiev, to court, and he could be on his way to jail. Since leaving office, Mr. Poroshenko has faced a barrage of investigations. His now regular court appearances have turned into rallies. This script was written in the Kremlin, he tells his supporters.
Petro Poroshenko's message is that this is a politically motivated prosecution backed by the man who defeated him in last year's presidential election, the former comedian Volodymyr Zelensky.
This is a revenge. This is a revenge of inexperienced politician.
I met up with Mr. Poroshenko at the headquarters of his political party, European Solidarity. I asked him if he now regretted the deeply personal nature of last year's election campaign, and in particular his campaign posters that suggested that a vote for Mr. Zelensky was effectively a vote for Russia's president, Vladimir Putin.
I was one of the most happiest person in the world, if I was wrong. But unfortunately, this is true. And the fifth column of Russian Federation are now playing a very important role in Ukraine.
What you're saying is extremely damning, potentially destabilizing for this country, to say that Ukraine's president is effectively Putin's man.
I'm not saying that the Ukrainian president is a Putin man. Never. I'm saying that he is quite inexperienced, and his team, who is consist of one of the person who was in Russia 5 years, all 5 years of my presidency, definitely play very negative role.
The irony is that Mr. Poroshenko had 5 years in charge and could have tried much harder to reform the rotten justice system that now pursues him. Instead, he must contend with more than 20 investigations on subjects varying from the legality of his appointments to the tax status of his paintings. So far, President Zelensky, supposedly a reformer, has discovered a newfound confidence in the integrity of Ukrainian justice. Denis Smigal is his prime minister.
I'm agreed with you that it looks not so good, but I'm sure that every person who made something bad, who violated the law, should be responsible for this. And I'm not happy that it happens in Ukraine.
By encouraging the pursuit of his predecessor, President Zelensky is taking a gamble. A few months ago, a defeated Petro Poroshenko was in the political wilderness. Now he's back and centre stage.
Jonah Fisher reporting from Kiev. The new security law, which came into force in Hong Kong last week, is already having an impact. At least one leading pro-democracy campaigner, Nathan Law, has left the territory. And now books written by prominent activists such as Joshua Wong have disappeared from the shelves in the city's libraries. One of the missing authors is the scholar Horace Chin, known as Wan Chi. He's been called the godfather of localism for his evocative writing about Hong Kong. He's been speaking to Lise Doucette.
It's quite a sad thing to see my books by Joshua as well as another legislator, which are no longer available for public reading. So it's a sad thing because censorship is quite unusual in Hong Kong, unless for some obviously sexual things, but not this kind of political writing.
Do you think this is now the new reality of Hong Kong after the new security law passed by Beijing?
I think so. They're coming, and they're coming more and more obviously. After freedom of speech, after books, after poster being posted on in restaurants as well as in the street.
Do you worry about your own safety?
Not yet, but I think they will come after me. They were increasing the pressure bit by bit by testing the reaction of Hong Kong people as well as the international world.
Wan Chi talking to Lise Doucette. And it is the international reach of the new law that is adding to concerns. James Kumarasamy has been hearing more about that from Bing Ling, a professor of Chinese law at the University of Sydney in Australia.
This law criminalizes conduct that occurs not only in Hong Kong, but outside Hong Kong as well. So according to this law, people anywhere in the world, whether Hong Kong residents or not, can be caught by this law if they commit the criminal conduct that this law prohibits. So this law has a global reach.
Global reach, not just in terms of, as you say, Hong Kong citizens then, but global citizens, people from any country can be caught up in it.
One of the most striking clauses in this law is its Article 38, which says people who are not Hong Kong permanent residents who commit crimes under the law will be governed by this law, which essentially means they will be criminally liable. They can be subject to extradition if possible, or they can be arrested or prosecuted when they enter into Hong Kong and China.
What would you say are the implications of that?
Although the law is written to cover everyone, I suppose it's primarily the overseas Chinese. And as we know, in the past year, there have been numerous protests, events all around the world in support of Hong Kong's protest movement. And what this extraterritorial provision does, apparently, is to deter these people and make sure that these people will think twice before they go onto the street and demonstrate their support.
How does that extraterritorial provision fit in with international law?
There is a principle under international law on protective jurisdiction. It is a principle that is quite generally recognized. Many states around the world recognize this principle. So in other words, a state can apply its law to foreign conduct, conduct by foreigners in a foreign country, if the conduct damages the vital interest and national security of that state. What this Hong Kong law is worrisome is that its criminal law provisions can be quite pervasive. So for instance, there is a crime of advocating independence of Hong Kong, even by peaceful means. There's also a provision that would prohibit any proposal or support for any sanctions against China, whether sanctions are justified or not. And these provisions, if they apply in the way that the law says, virtually means, for instance, any legislators who vote for a sanction bill against China could, in theory at least, be caught by this law.
Professor of Chinese Law, Bing Ling. Now, a request for your help.
The Global News Podcast has been nominated for an award, and we need your help and your votes if we're to win. The Listener's Choice Award recognises the best UK podcast as voted for by its fans. To cast your vote, head to britishpodcastawards.com/vote. Search Global News Podcast in the search bar. Enter your name and email address to verify your details. Press submit and you'll receive an email back. Just hit confirm and that's it. You voted. The deadline for voting is 12 noon BST on the 6th of July. Just head to britishpodcastawards.com/vote and choose the Global News Podcast.
And still to come on the Global News Podcast.
The gorillas control this area. They didn't permit to come here. They said, this area is for us.
The natural wonders of Colombia that were opening up after decades of conflict, just as the virus hit. Formula One has returned after a four-month delay because of the COVID-19 pandemic. The first race of the season, the Austrian Grand Prix, was won by Valtteri Bottas in a Mercedes. Before the start, the drivers gathered to take a collective stand against racism. 14 of them took a knee, led by six-time champion Lewis Hamilton.
I won't stop pushing until we really see change, and so we've really got to dig deep. There are still people that don't fully understand exactly what is happening and what are the reasons for these protests, and I continue to try and be that guider.
But six of the drivers remained standing. So what was going on? The BBC's Jenny Gow was watching the race.
Well, I think it's important to say that all of the drivers came out with a statement yesterday saying that they all want to end racism. They all support diversity, and they felt that that was very important to say, regardless of what actions they took today. And there was some disagreement with how best for the drivers to deal with today. For example, Max Verstappen, one of the drivers who did not take the knee, said, "I'm very committed to equality and the fight against racism, but I also believe everyone has the right to express themselves at a time and in a way that suits them." So he's just one of the drivers that didn't take the knee. Charles Leclerc, another, said that, "I believe what matters are facts and behaviours in our daily life rather than formal gestures that could be seen as controversial in some countries." And I do think that was the problem that some of the drivers had. They were worried about the fact that taking the knee is seen in different ways in different places. But they all stand united in the message they want to say, which is that we need to end racism.
And what of the race itself? I guess when you're sat on your own in a car, you're pretty social distance from other people, but otherwise no crowds, etc.
Yeah, no crowds, which is strange, but actually during the race you didn't really notice it. I think Max Verstappen, if he'd have won, you would have noticed that his fans weren't there because a sea of them go to what is Red Bull's home circuit in Austria. You probably would have noticed flares not being at the circuit, but other than that, it just felt like a normal race, really. What wasn't normal were the celebrations afterwards, no big podium celebration. Yes, the champagne was sprayed liberally. I think they might have to look at that going forward. But it is F1 in 2020. It is very different. But luckily, it was a great race. So that distracted everybody from any of the issues, I suppose.
Jenny Gow. For decades, many of Colombia's natural wonders were off limits because of fighting between government forces and rebels. The Melcocha River, a crystal clear waterway just outside Medellin, was taken over by guerrilla groups. But families who fled the conflict have been returning to the area, kickstarting an eco-tourist industry. However, their plans were put on hold by COVID-19. Our reporter Victoria Stunt visited the area before the outbreak and has now caught up with some of those she met.
A corner of Colombia before the pandemic hit. Tourists swimming in the clear waters of the Melcocha River.
The birds, the animals, very nice clean river.
20 years ago, according to Jose Serna, this would not have happened.
Impossible. Impossible. Why? Because the gorillas control this area. They didn't permit to come here to visit because they said, this area is for us.
Jose is the director of tourism in Corcorna, the first it has ever had. In the late 1990s, he was mayor here, but fled with his family to Canada after being kidnapped by rebels. He's one of the many returnees who saw a bright future as tourists began to book. Orlando Soto is another. He was in his 30s when left-wing FARC guerrillas and right-wing paramilitaries began to fight over the area. The FARC told the community to choose sides.
We either stayed with them or we became military targets. So that night we all went to think, and the next day there was a mass exodus. There was total chaos, social disarray, everything. A lot of things happened there.
Orlando worked for years in Venezuela, but returned in 2014 to open a campsite and restaurant. The lockdown has emptied both. The river is more beautiful than ever, but what we need is financial support. We don't have any, he tells me now. Both men believe there will be no tourists this year, but there could be one upside. After the conflict, researchers were able to access the area for the first time in decades and found six previously unknown species, including plants, a fish, and a beetle. Gisela Martinez works in the tourism industry, but she also leads a community group that watches over the river. She says that local people must balance ecology with tourism for the sake of the Melcocho.
As they always say, this is a little gold mine. If we don't learn to take care of it and preserve it, one day it will run dry.
Hello.
Hi, Jose. How are you? When I reach Jose by telephone, the head of tourism says he will use the next months to make sure the community thinks about how to strike that balance.
This is the grand opportunity. It's a very nice opportunity for us to work together. The people, they are living in that place. They said, we need to say to the tourists, this is a beautiful place, but you need to take care with that.
While parts of Colombia are still off limits because of insecurity, the people of Corcorna hope their isolation is temporary. And when tourists do return, it will be to a place that can both cope with and welcome them.
Victoria Stunt reporting from Colombia. Next to Algeria and a funeral for 24 resistance fighters killed by French forces more than 150 years ago. The bodies had been repatriated from France after a long struggle by Algerian historians to get them brought home. Our reporter Richard Hamilton told me their story.
Well, you have to go back a long time in history. France invaded Algeria back in 1830, and these people died in a rebellion in the 1840s. And the history of France and Algeria is particularly bloody and tragic. But it all started in a very minor incident. The Ottoman ruler of Algeria got into an argument with the French consul and struck him with a fly whisk. And this was called the fly whisk incident. And it provided France with a pretext for a full-scale invasion in 1830. And then, as I say, there was a rebellion early on in the 1840s. And about 800 people were massacred in a small village called Zatcha in 1849. And the French wanted to put down any rebellion and teach the Algerians a lesson. So they not only killed these resistance fighters, but they decapitated them and took the skulls back as trophies. And they eventually ended up in a museum called the Museum of Man in Paris near the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah, and they've only recently been repatriated. Was that part of this growing movement to address the legacy of colonialism?
Exactly, yes, and it's particularly strong now in the light of the death of George Floyd in the United States. And Emmanuel Macron is the first French president to be born after the Algerian War of Independence. And back in 2019, he said colonialism was a grave mistake. And he also called the colonialization of Algeria a crime against humanity. And he also, on a visit to West Africa, he promised that looted artifacts from Benin would also be repatriated. So it's very much part of that movement.
And will France be doing more to address its legacy in Algeria?
Yeah, Algeria's called for a full apology and the handover of more of these skulls, as well as the national archives from that time, and also compensation for nuclear weapons testing in the Algerian Sahara in the early 1960s.
Richard Hamilton. This weekend marked a big easing of the lockdown in England, but it wasn't just pubs and hairdressers that were able to reopen. People were also able to get a cultural fix by visiting museums and art galleries. One venue just north of London is filled with work by one of Britain's great modern artists. And our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd was there as it reopened.
If you'd all like to take a sticker as well for the grounds. Yes, there.
The Henry Moore Studios and Gardens in Perry Green, Hertfordshire, display in a large and beautiful location work by one of Europe's best-known sculptors.
There's also mats there if anyone wants one. There's also more hand sanitizer if you want to, like, wash your hands after touching the stuff, or if you haven't sanitized out there yet.
The studios should have reopened at Easter. Now the site where Henry Moore worked until his death in 1986 is one of the first artistic attractions in England to unlock for what's left of the summer. Much of what's here is in the open air, but Leslie Wake of the Moore Foundation says some things will change.
One of the beauties of Henry Moore's outdoor bronzes is that in normal times, people can go up and touch them and feel the way that the different patinations feel when they're cast in bronze. This year, we are asking people not to touch, because clearly we can't go around wiping all of our sculptures with alcohol all the time. It would spoil the finish. So we wash them with warm soapy water to make sure they're clean, but for visitor protection, best that they don't touch this year.
Since March, museums and galleries around the world have been trying to persuade art lovers that the digital experience can replace seeing physical art. First day visitors, Lisa and Peter, remain unconvinced.
Seeing something online is great, but there's no substitute for seeing it actually in the flesh.
Definitely very different when you're here. And being outside is obviously a bonus. We've got beautiful flowers and wildlife. There's a red kite flying around, so it's a great experience all around. Because when you do it online, there's sort of a one-dimensional camera view. And to be able to come and see the texture and just, yeah, particularly being outside here is really amazing.
Why have you come here?
To get out, really. Get the kids out and see some lovely sculptures and probably go to the cafe.
Leslie Wake says people trek out to the Henry Moore for a variety of reasons. She's sure this summer one of the most important will be to find escape in the open air.
They are looking for an open space that's not a parkland crammed with lots of picnickers, and to be in the open air. If you want to enjoy the sculptures, you can have peace and tranquility in a large open space, and I think people will really relish that this particular year.
Leslie Wake from the Moore Foundation, ending that report by Vincent Dowd. And that is all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.